It's really a pleasure for me to be the chair of this ethnomusicology panel. I worked in ethnomusicology archives for many years of my life at the Indiana University Archives of Traditional Music and also at the UCLA Ethnomusicology Archive. And I know we have a couple of people here today from the Ethnomusicology Archive at UCLA. And so one of my really lifelong interests has been new collections at ethnomusicology archives and also use of older collections at ethnomusicology archives. So I think we'll have an opportunity this morning to hear from two people who are making these kinds of contributions to and from ethnomusicology archives. First of all, I'm going to introduce Laura Schnitger. She is a PhD candidate in ethnomusicology at the University of Maryland, and she has taught classes in the history of rock and roll, world popular musics and identity, and the impact of music on social life. The subject of her dissertation concerns freeform DJ as a primary agent in the construction of independent music culture. And also, she works as an archives assistant at the Library of American Broadcasting and hosts a weekly radio show on WMUC-FM in College Park, Maryland. But today, she is going to be talking about WLW in Cincinnati, once the most powerful radio station in the United States, and Edwin Dooley, who began working at the radio station in the 1950s and served as the station's chief engineer from 1961 to 1987. So I think we'll all be interested to hear more about this man and his work in the radio station. So welcome, Laura.
Thank you. In 1921, a Cincinnati auto accessories designer named Powell Crosley Jr. agreed to buy his son a wireless radio for his birthday. Dismayed by the cost of $130, Crosley and his son left the store that day without a radio. What they bought instead was a 5-cent textbook on how to build one. A few months later, the elder Crosley had become entirely fixated on radio manufacturing and broadcasting. He believed that radios should be affordable, and by the end of the year, he and a couple engineers figured out how to mass produce radios that only cost $15. He also broadcast recorded music on a 20-watt transmitter from his garage so that future customers would have a reason to buy one. Here's Powell Crosley Jr. with Bonzo and the Pup, which is the name he gave his small one-tube regenerative radio. And the original pair, Pup and Bonzo, cost $9.75 in 1925. Today, they're worth almost $1,700. By 1934, Crosley had created an empire. WLW in Cincinnati, known as the Nation Station, became the first and last radio station in the United States to broadcast with a 500,000-watt transmitter. The station's engineers received reports that it was being picked up in Australia on clear nights, and listeners throughout North America could tune into comedy, drama, suspense, soap operas, news, music, quiz shows, farming, and market reports nearly 20 hours a day, 7 days a week. It is little wonder why Crosley was nicknamed the Henry Ford of radio. This is the WLW transmitter building and guard tower. To the right of it is a photo of the antenna, which was built in 1933, and to my knowledge, it is still there. In March 1947, WLW celebrated 25 years on the air. On their anniversary show, the station reenacted the very first broadcast, which had occurred on March 2nd, 1922.
The first broadcast from our studio in Cincinnati. You will hear first the prologue of Magatti, sung by Mr. Giacinto Gorka, and accompanied by his brother, Romeo Gorka, at the piano, led by Mr. William Morgan Knox and the Cincinnati Symphony Orchestra playing the violin.
Later, I'm able to play that for you thanks to the efforts of a man named Edwin Dooley. Dooley began working at WLW in the 1950s. He became chief engineer in 1961 and remained in that position until he retired in 1987. As head of the department with a keen interest in radio history, Dooley continually salvaged materials such as microphones and photos from being thrown away. According to WLW historian Mike Martini, Dooley's greatest contribution to radio history came in the late 70s when management decided that a storage barn needed to be emptied and its contents destroyed. Thousands of recorded materials were then tossed into a Dropbox dumpster. When Ed found out, he literally climbed into the dumpster to grab as many discs as he could. He added to his collection over the years and continued to do so even after his retirement from WLW. He worked as a broadcast property broker, helping to appraise and sell radio and TV stations around the country. Often he'd be at a station and notice the large forgotten filing cabinets in the back room with transcription labels such as Standard, Orthacoustic, and Capital. Young program directors were only too glad to let Ed get rid of them, and he would gleefully cart them out, cabinets and all. Between that and the occasional garage sale find, the Ed Dooley collection was created. Dooley passed away in 1998. His friend and co-worker, Clyde Hanley, contacted the Library of American Broadcasting on behalf of Dooley's widow, who knew the importance of her husband's collection. By April 2000, the LAB acquired about 6,000 transcription discs and about 230 7-inch reel-to-reels. I began my work on the Dooley collection in the fall of 2004. I have so far cleaned, played, and archived about 1,500 discs. This has given me a pretty good understanding of the nature of radio broadcasts in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s, the decades that historians consider the golden age of radio. I believe the fact that the very first broadcast on WLW included a live music performance is telling and important. Radio forever changed the way music was performed and consumed here in the United States. It is my aim today to show that exploring past broadcasts can reveal what kind of changes took place as music programs infused American life. I will briefly describe my cleaning and preservation methods, then play and contextualize the content of two of the rarest discs that have surfaced so far in the collection. The first step in organizing the discs is cleaning them. My initial cleaning process is safe for almost all types of discs, whether they're made from vinyl, glass, aluminum, or acetate, the one exception being cardboard. Cleaning prevents damage to the record needle, helps reduce surface noise during playback, and slows the process of deterioration. The cleaning solution I use is a combination of Murphy's oil and distilled water. Discs are cleaned by gently working the solution into the grooves with a stiff brush. Once the entire surface is coated, I rinse the solution off with distilled water, dry the disc with a cotton cloth, and put it on the shelf to dry. Acetate discs sometimes need more thorough cleaning due to their chemical structure. Most acetate discs manufactured in the mid-1930s to the late 1950s were coated with nitrocellulose containing castor oil as plasticizer, which breaks down and eventually disappears during the aging process. This deterioration results in a greasy white powder composed of fatty acids that covers the surface of the disc. A recent investigation at Georgia State University found the safest way to remove most of the residue is by simply applying Kodak lens cleaner with a stiff brush. Lens cleaner is more than 99% water and less than 1% ammonium carbonate, a fluid which dissolves the fatty acids. This slide shows the condition of the acetate disc before and after the cleaning process. Once a disc has been cleaned and played, I place it in an acid-free archive folder and file it in an archival box. The discs are filed upright so they won't be harmed by bearing excess weight. The first disc I'm going to talk about today is a Sons of the Pioneers audition record. The Sons of the Pioneers were an all-male vocal and instrumental group specializing in cowboy and western songs. Formed in 1933 by Leonard Sly, who would later become Roy Rogers, Bob Nolan, and Tim Spencer, the Pioneer Trio made their debut on Los Angeles radio station KFWB. Their on-air rapport with one another, their seamless vocal harmonies, and superb arrangements quickly earned them a large following. They were local radio stars until 1934 when their program began to air nationally. Since they had added new members and were no longer a trio, and since the radio announcer decided they were too young to have been pioneers, he introduced them to America as the Sons of the Pioneers, and the name stuck. For the next 5 decades, the group worked continually, writing and recording songs and programs for national syndication, cutting albums, making almost 100 appearances in Western films, and performing live concerts. Though the lineup changed repeatedly over the years, the Sons of the Pioneers remained one of the most popular and best-loved country music groups in the U.S. In 1976, they were inducted into the Country Music Hall of Fame. A Sons of the Pioneers audition record from the Dooley Collection is important for several reasons. Because audition records were never intended for either broadcast or sale, it functions as a kind of audio resume for the group during the so-called golden years of their fame. References to their achievements in movies, radio programs, and the names mentioned in the then-current lineup date this disc around 1947. Because the Sons of the Pioneers had few commercial releases before 1952, much of the original group's repertoire is preserved on syndicated transcription discs. The personnel on this audition record, two of whom were founding members, are considered the classic lineup for the group, most widely recognized for their film appearances in the previous 2 decades. Musically, this disc reveals some important aspects about the intersection of radio, folk, and popular music. The Pioneers' music clearly appealed to a sense of regional identity among American listeners. Unlike their contemporary, Woody Guthrie, whose songs about the West tended to be socially critical, the Pioneers portrayed a more isolated and mystic West, one based in rugged individualism and nature's benevolence. Though not all the group's members were actually from the West, Bob Nolan, the main songwriter, was born in New Brunswick, Canada, they helped to create a romantic conception of its landscape and lifestyle that found increasing favor in popular culture. But to gain a larger audience, the Pioneers had to broaden their repertoire with tunes that were more familiar. You'll hear in this sound clip how Nolan appeals to a wider fan base. If this were an actual broadcast, you can imagine you're hearing it for the first time on your 1947 Crosley radio.
Presenting America's favorite singers, the Sons of the Pioneers.
Dancing along with a tumbling tumbleweed.
Hi, Bill. This is Bob Nolan with all the Sons of the Pioneers. We believe we have something new and different in a program of your favorite songs. You know, for the last 15 years, we've been collecting these numbers, not just Westerns, but every type of song that radio audiences hold near and dear to their hearts. Popular standards, sentimental ballads, spirituals, folk songs, the best in Western music, and harmony favorites. Yes, harmony favorites. Like this one.
Shine on, marvelous moon, up in the sky. January, February, June, or July.
This song, Shine On Harvest Moon, was a product of Tin Pan Alley from the early 1900s and became a pop standard after its 1908 debut in the Ziegfeld Follies. The Pioneers' unique renditions of old favorites allowed them to expand their audience to include people who were unfamiliar or uninterested in cowboy songs. Listen to this clip of the announcer speaking directly to radio station programmers and how, like Nolan, he repeats the word favorite to suggest that all tuners in will hear something that they recognize.
At this point in the program, you will present your first sales message. Here, your local announcer will take charge with a ready-made, receptive audience. Two musical numbers already have been presented, and listeners are aware that it's a show built especially for them under your banner with their favorite songs and their favorite personality, the Sons of the Pioneers.
A 1934 radio survey conducted by two psychologists found that when it came to music, old-time favorites topped listeners' order of preference. Familiarity, they claimed, means knowledge. It means associations, tied images, and correct anticipation of the sequence of melody and words. The more a listener knows about a composition, the better he enjoys it. Songwriter Irving Berlin echoed this sentiment when he told the New York Times that same year that radio's most valuable asset is old songs. The old songs have a quality of association to the listener. They're like old friends. While some would dismiss the commercialization of folk music as a kind of cultural loss, I believe this record invites us to re-examine that process. I would argue that radio actually enabled the growth and development of more musical styles. It provided a context in which songs could find new relevance to subsequent generations. It became a site where distinctive regional sounds could adapt to popular tastes without necessarily compromising their authenticity. As the 20th century progressed, the American soundscape became a macrocosm of music genres. And in addition to traditional country, the Pioneers exerted a strong influence on rockabilly, folk, soul, jazz, R&B, and of course rock and roll. A sound recording from a radio archive, particularly one that the public was never meant to hear, can provide important clues about the process of creating those genres. Another rare find in the Dooley collection, and one that also comes from the country music genre, is a one-of-a-kind broadcast of a weekly live show from Cincinnati called Boone County Jamboree. The story behind this particular recording is probably the most historically significant of any of the discs in the collection. In the mid to late 1930s, when WLW was experimenting with its 500,000-watt transmitter, the FCC responded to complaints from other radio stations who feared their own broadcasts could not compete with a superpower. One such station was WOR in New Jersey, whose managers claimed that WLW was interfering with their nighttime broadcasts. While Crosley and other station personnel battled it out in court, a group of engineers from WLW set out to try and prove that this was not the case. According to Bill Alberts, a former WLW engineer, they made two field recording trips. From October to December in 1938, the engineers drove from Cincinnati, Ohio to Calais, Maine. They set up an antenna at certain points along the way and made visual and audio records of both WLW and WOR signals. From January to March 1939, the group drove down from Ohio to Pensacola, Florida, doing the same thing. In March 1939, however, the FCC made their final decision to cut WLW's transmitter back to 50,000 watts. Therefore, the field recordings were not needed, and no final report was ever written on the project. The historical value of these discs remains as a document of the state of radio technology and widespread broadcasting practices in the eastern United States in the 1930s. Moreover, we now have a sound record of local broadcasts that often featured regional music programs. And because most of these programs were not syndicated, few, if any, copies of them survive. Such is the case with Boone County Jamboree. WLW historian Lawrence Lichty noted that for almost two decades, beginning in the 1920s, WLW maintained one of the largest and most famous staffs of hillbilly and country entertainers of any radio station. These shows laid the foundation for the popularizing of country and western music, as it came to be called after about 1950. Country music historian Bill Malone claims that this music probably reached the ears of most Americans via radio, and until approximately World War II, most of the radio transmission was done through live performances and by entertainers who, for the most part, never made any phonograph records. He also points out that country music was at its most natural in the personal appearance, and presumably the audience was more devoted and folkish in this setting than in any other. For an ethnomusicologist researching early country music, this next record constitutes a vital primary source. It includes a group called the Drifting Pioneers performing live on Boone County Jamboree on January 13, 1939. The group featured a young Merle Travis on guitar, who plays a solo here, and you'll hear his cue. Travis went on to become one of the most famous country music stars in the 20th century. Unparalleled in his playing and songwriting abilities, he is credited with the invention of a strumming technique called Travis picking. This is the only known recording of the Drifting Pioneers. And here it is on your 1930s Crosley Companion.
Well, thanks, Doug. Now we're getting all of this Boone County Jamboree in its own house. I have the 55 there come up here and play and sing Ballads of the Same Old South. Come down, boys.
At 500,000 watts, WLW made its homespun Boone County Jamboree accessible to an unimaginably vast audience. We may never know the extent to which live country music from rural Ohio influenced the rest of the world, but the very idea that this was possible as far back as 1939 suggests that the rapid globalization of music began much earlier than we often assume. Ethnomusicologist and archivist Anthony Seeger, who's here at the conference, called archives places of discovery and rediscovery. Radio archives in particular offer new modes for understanding a culture's musical output. They can show us when and how songs and identities took new forms. They can afford us the chance to hear live performances that would have been lost had it not been for the heroic efforts of dumpster diving sound engineers. They can help us trace the provenance of the listening habits we now take for granted, and they can reacquaint us with the foundations upon which our media-oriented lives were built. Thank you.
If anybody has any questions for Laura, they're welcome.
Yes.
I've heard a lot about cross-border radio, that the radio stations that set up in Mexico and broadcast on large lots. I'm wondering, have you heard about that, and how does their watts compare to WLW? Is it comparable? Or?
Well, to my knowledge, nobody even came close to 500,000. I think the going wattage around that time was 50,000. And I know that now 100,000 is the absolute limit for any radio station. Because my research is concentrated in the United States, particularly in the rural areas of the country, I can't comment too much on cross-cultural radio stations where languages were different and where broadcasts came in from other nations. I know not a lot of work has been done in this area. I actually have a colleague down in Austin who's looking at, from a Mexican standpoint, how their radio broadcasts have affected identity and so forth. But I'm afraid I can't say a lot more than that. Research yet to be done. So.
Any other questions or comments? Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Laura.